On this week's 51%, a College of Medicine department chair takes us into the vaccination controversy.
Very polarized views around vaccination are not new historically.
And we hear about one woman's march to activism. I'm Allison Dunn, and this is 51%. It's a heated and controversial topic, vaccination. Bernice Hausman does not proclaim which side is right, but investigates the controversy itself, looking into why this debate is so charged at this time. Through her research, Hausman discovers vaccine skepticism is linked to various beliefs and practices that are typical of American society and that are sustained by popular suspicions of the government, sponsored scientific research, and pharmaceutical companies. Yet our societal narrative has simplified this complex controversy into the misinformed, irrational, vaccine-fearing parent, which Hausman believes does a disservice to both a full understanding of the issue as well as the health of our democratic society. Hausman's exploration of the topic is the basis of her book, Anti-Vax, Reframing the Vaccination Controversy. Hausman is chair of the Department of Humanities at the Penn State College of Medicine.
After 2000, after 2005, colleagues and friends of mine who were having kids at that time were nervous about vaccination. And I had my kids in the mid-90s, and I was not aware at all of any kind of vaccination concerns, even though I was in some social circles having to do with breastfeeding support, where it would have put me in contact with people who were vaccine hesitant or skeptical. And so I was interested in that. I was interested in the sort of why people were nervous. I hosted a baby shower for a friend of mine, and somebody who came gave her two books about delaying vaccination. So I thought, I was like, wow, that's really interesting. I didn't know that was a thing. So that was one thing that interested me. And the second thing that brought me to the topic was that I was interested in creating a team-based, collaborative humanities research group with students. And I was at Virginia Tech at the time, and the group of students I was going to be working with were mostly pre-med students. And so I wanted a topic that I thought that I could engage students in, that I could draw students to the research group, and that they would be able to do some primary research in the area that would sustain their interest and the project as a whole. And that was true. I have since then run this research group every semester, and then I brought it to Penn State College of Medicine, where I'm now working with medical students on a new sort of angle on the topic.
Oh, interesting. So, and correct me if I'm wrong when I say this, but you're not out to say this side's right, this side's wrong, but really investigate the controversy itself. Is that, talk about that a bit more, because obviously there's so many topics we could bring up right now that are controversial. Why this?
Well, so one of the things that I learned actually from doing this research was that coming at it from a specific position is not helpful. So we started the research group with the idea that I was called the Vaccine Refusal Research Group. So that title itself gives you the sense that, well, we're studying those people who don't agree with vaccination. And we did this research for about a semester and realized that was not the right way to approach a topic in which what we were really interested in understanding is why there is this controversy. And one of the reasons that it's so fascinating is that we have really high national vaccination rates in this country. You can look at the CDC data from any given year. There's maybe, a few decimal point percentage differences one year to the next, but we don't have trending down. We have, if anything, trending up and flat, very strong rates of vaccination nationally. So we have this, basically overwhelming support for vaccination at the same time as we have political controversy, concerns, hesitations, and an inflammatory kind of reporting context. So that, to me, was very interesting, and it showed to me that the controversy itself, how did we get here, what motivates it, what animates it now, what sustains it and keeps it going, are the interesting questions to ask.
It's interesting. I'm looking at your book cover, And it just struck me now, although I've seen your book cover weeks ago, that it's the colors speak to me as being gray, kind of black, kind of white. And just, I don't know, that just struck me right now. But the subtitle, Reframing the Vaccination Controversy, how does it need to be reframed? What do you think it was? What is it becoming or should it become?
Well, so there are a lot of different frames. And so it's not like it is one thing now and it should become one thing in the future. I think that the general reframing is that I would seek is that that vaccine dissent is meaningful. So it doesn't mean that it's correct. It doesn't mean that people who are vaccine promoters need to agree with people who dissent from vaccination. But the current framing of the vaccine dissenter as irrational, stupid, scientifically illiterate, that's not a helpful framing, right? That doesn't help communities speak across ideological divides. It certainly doesn't help people in public health when there is an outbreak in a community to have such a polarized and inflammatory context. So that would be one reframing. Another reframing is to think about the vaccine dissenter is not always a parent of a child with autism. That they're actually, and I show this in the first couple chapters of the book, that from the 80s through 2005, like from the in the 1980s, news reporting on vaccination concern was very varied, and that was true through the 90s as well. There were lots of different concerns that emerged, and oftentimes there was a set of concerns that would emerge parallel to a set of concerns about infectious disease. So you have kind of two parallel tracks of development of treatments for infectious disease and development of vaccines for infectious disease at the same time that you have increasing concerns about vaccination and other kinds of technological approaches to disease and illness. So, and those get, or after 2000, those really fall away. The diversity and heterogeneity of reporting falls away in a lot of mainstream outlets, and you get this focus on the irrational vaccine-hesitant parent as the kind of core of vaccine hesitancy. And I think that needs to be reframed as well. That framing ignores many different kinds of concerns that people have. Especially the focus on this parent as an affluent, educated parent. So the notion that people who are poor, or people from underrepresented groups, don't have concerns. So there's a kind of a narrowing that has happened historically in this country that obscures to us the heterogeneity of concerns around vaccination.
I was going to ask you about the link to autism, because that is something that's referenced among some of those who don't want to vaccinate their children. And interestingly enough, I just saw on Twitter, I think literally yesterday or the day before, a link to a vaccine advocate who put a video on TikTok and is kind of older than the average TikTok user, and said, "Oh, this is my first foray into it," and put together this short video, which is what TikTok is about, short videos,
yeah,
about why you should vaccinate. And I thought that was kind of interesting because of the platform she chose and where to get that message out, because that's generally a much younger audience on TikTok. So I thought that was
right.
Kind of interesting. And just to expand, this kind of goes a little bit with what you were saying before. So when you're talking about, okay, vaccination is science, right? Here's what a vaccine does. And then you talk about vaccine skepticism. So does that require maybe a social response then to vaccine skepticism?
Right. Well, that's what I argue in the book. So vaccines are the product of scientific research and invention. They're products, they're material things that are part of a kind of an armamentarium of public health to protect people from infectious disease in a preventative sense, right? So not like a preventative sense of sort of acting on the body. And vaccines work generally the same way to prime the immune system to be prepared for a future viral or bacterial infection, so that your body is primed to already have antibodies and already have the same sort of natural response we would have. Let's say, for example, if we naturally got the chicken pox, as I did as a child, that when I'm then in an outbreak of children who have the chicken pox, I'm immune because my my immune system has already experienced that. So the vaccine works. This is from the vaccinology point of view. The vaccine works to harness the natural immune system. But vaccines are, you know, as objects in the world, they travel socially and they do their work in communities, in nations, and globally, and they are also a part of legal context. As we in this country, we have school entry mandates that are part of state law, and so you have vaccine acceptance is vaccines are accepted or not by people in social contexts, and people have a variety of reasons to dissent from vaccination, and those range from skepticism about the scientific story that I just told, right, that vaccines are effective, concerns about unanticipated adverse event reactions to vaccines. There's long-standing historical concerns that vaccines can cause chronic illness. In addition, there are other sorts of more legalistic or concerns that the state should not require people to be vaccinated, that that's an incursion into people's innate personal liberty, that the state has no power to define or regulate familial health. And then there are other sorts of concerns about the whether or not too many vaccines are an assault upon the child's body, since children now get so many vaccines between ages 0 and 2. And so there's concern about the effect of that many vaccines. So you can see there's a sort of a range of concerns that are both based in a kind of quasi-scientific understanding of the effect of vaccines, but also some of them really located in the social political sphere.
With all of that said, it does become an issue of, I chose to vaccinate my child, or how dare you put he or she in danger. It's one thing if you're in your own house and you're never coming out, do what you want with your children if it doesn't affect the health of my children. And, you know, I think you were speaking to group immunity before. You know, you need X number vaccinated in community to have this kind of group immunity. It just seems so much so in the last decade that it's become so polarizing. Is this just more because perhaps we feel our rights are being infringed upon more given a certain political landscape, or, you know, we're just more outspoken on because there's social media? I mean, what is the media itself responsible for some of this controversy or any misinformation?
Well, so there were riots in Britain and the United States in the late 1800s around mandatory smallpox vaccinations. So very polarized views around vaccination are not new historically. So what I would say, what I'd like to say, is that there's thematic continuity in the concerns about vaccination going all the way back to the early 19th century. So the smallpox vaccine was developed in the late 18th century, and so as soon as it started to be used, and then there were compulsory laws in both Britain and the United States and elsewhere, there immediately started to be concerns and resistance. So there are thematically consistent historical trends, but the current moment then adds in the sort of ingredients of our moment to sort of stir the pot and make them situated historically in our time. So yeah, there is an element of the sort of social networks that operate in social media on the internet that have a particular way of helping certain kinds of ideas travel and influence people. You noted earlier the measles outbreaks in Rockland County in New York City, and it was very interesting to me that there was a group that created a pamphlet, kind of a booklet about that was very anti-vaccine for those specific ultra-Orthodox communities that don't use the internet. So, I mean, to the extent that at the end of the booklet, there's like you can call a particular phone number, and if you punch in which number, you can get somebody telling you about certain kinds of problems with vaccines. So a kind of a compendium of vaccine dissenting arguments that are in a booklet for people who aren't using the internet. So I think that for me at least, it's helpful to know that while the arguments that we see now seem particularly located in our time, that they have historical precedent, because it's also a way of calming down. It's like, oh, well, people have been concerned about vaccines or concerned about this issue for over 100 years, or, oh, well, this trend is linked to this long historical record of people who feel that it's not the government's role to tell me what to do with my body. But that helps actually to diffuse some of the what I think of as really hysteria around vaccination concern today. And maybe will help us find ways to talk to each other about those very concerns that you raised in the beginning of your question. How do we support community health in the context of people who have divergent views about the value of vaccination?
You know, I'm wondering what you uncovered in researching for this book that surprised you, if anything.
So the zombie novel chapter in the book was the one that really taught me about a kind of deep level of distrust of the government and the elite bureaucracies. The idea that the zombie novel tells us that people are concerned that in the context of a zombie apocalypse, the government will sacrifice some people in order to save civilization. That structure is a basic structure of concern around vaccination, that the acknowledgement that some people, given how many doses of vaccines are delivered, some people will be injured, and we don't necessarily know who they are. Because we don't know, you know, everything about an individual's vulnerabilities or susceptibilities, that some people will be injured, and that that is okay in the context of the greater good. So it surprised me that I could see that that sort of trend in thinking and that concern kind of bubble up in apocalyptic fiction, and that it showed me how strong that concern is.
Interesting. What do you hope readers take away from your book?
So I hope they take away the notion that a lot of people who vaccinate and don't vaccinate, actually share a number of concerns about the future of the planet, about the meaning of illness in our lives, and about what our relationship is to sort of medical advice and the meaning of science in the way that we live our lives. That many, many people who are on all sides of vaccination controversy actually share a lot of concerns. But we may not act the same way on those concerns. So my hope is that people can find a way to think about the common ground that they share and that they see also in themselves a desire to have different kinds of conversations around questions about vaccination and infectious disease rather than the ones that we're having now.
Did you see a change or did your view change at all on the role of government in vaccination? Because obviously, as a result of what happened in Rockland County in New York City, at least in New York, we have a new law about exemptions.
Right. So it's going to be really, really interesting to see what we have, not just in New York, but Washington State passed a law for to get rid of exemptions, non-medical exemptions, for measles, mumps, and rubella vaccination. Maine passed a law. New Jersey was in the process of possibly passing a law, but hasn't yet. So here's historically, vaccine exemptions, non-medical exemptions to vaccine mandates help make the mandates work politically by allowing people who are very determined not to vaccinate to give them an out. Right, so you defuse the political energy behind resistance to vaccination by allowing those people who really don't want to vaccinate to give them an opportunity to do so. So that's been historically the interpretation of how vaccine mandates and the exemption process works, and that interpretation started with the conscientious objector law in Britain in the early 20th century to smallpox vaccination. So I think we're in the middle of a time right now where we're going to see what is going to happen with these new mandates. New York State has a very, very high vaccination rate for measles. So what it'll be interesting to see what kind of marginal increases in vaccination they get from this new law. The evidence in California suggests that there will be a rise in medical exemptions to vaccination. There will be an increase in children being homeschooled, and that there may be a nominal increase in vaccination that is based on schools doing a better job of record keeping and also not allowing children into school contingent on their getting a vaccination soon, but actually sort of following up and making sure that parents who intend to vaccinate actually do so. The question is whether or not clusters of ideologically committed non-vaccinators will change as a result of these laws. And I think that's an open question.
Certainly, and as you well know, New York looked to California in crafting its law.
There was a recent article in Pediatrics that suggests that the increases in the vaccination rate in California subsequent to the change of their law has really been nominal, that there's an increase in medical exemptions, and also that nominal increase in vaccination was not actually due to the restrictions on exemptions, but actually due to better work by schools to follow up with families to ensure that children who were going to be vaccinated were in fact vaccinated.
Is there anything else you wanted to mention? Please feel free.
Well, you know, one of the things that's been really interesting to me as I've done this series of radio interviews is how much people seem to want a different kind of conversation. That people are tired of this sort of vilifying, inflammatory, blaming, and shaming conversation around vaccines that we have today. I think it's because it echoes other politically polarized contexts that are just becoming so tiresome, that we want ways to make connection. We want other ways to think about problems. And so that has been really gratifying to me, because I think my book fits with that trend. It didn't initiate that trend, but it certainly fits with it in the sense that let's, you know, regardless of where we each individually stand on whether we think vaccination is a good or a bad thing, how can we not engage in the same old conversation about this, even in the face of outbreaks of infectious disease, and even in the face of the numerous measles cases in this country that we had this past year? Can we find another way to talk about what's going on and to address the way we differ as citizens in a democracy?
That was Bernice Hausman, author of Anti-Vax, Reframing the Vaccination Controversy. It's Women's History Month, and we're going to return to recent history, emphasis on recent. Billy Mays is an administrative assistant and single mother from a Trump-supporting family in Cincinnati, Ohio. In 2017, somewhat by accident, she led the first women's march in that city. She continued for the march that took place this year as well. WISO Community Voices producer Susan Burns brings us the story of how that action has led to activism.
I saw one lady that was organizing buses from Cincinnati to D.C. for the women's march there. And I basically said, like, how can I help? We need to have a local march.
Billy Mays takes a break from her job as an administrative assistant to talk about her first encounter with the women's march.
And I was just, you know, assuming I was just going to help, you know, organize or, you know, kind of get people together. I ended up being the whole face of the 2017 Women's March. I mean, just the media and everything was just, you know, amazing to me. I'd never in my life been on the news or, you know, had anything like that. So in 3 weeks, we put together this beautiful event that myself and really just one other woman put together. And then to see 14,000 people show up here for that. So I knew we had done something right. So
for most of her life, Billy would never have called herself an activist. But a few years ago, when a friend committed suicide, she began a project to conduct random acts of kindness. Billy, a single mom who was born and raised in Cincinnati, lives with her daughter just upstairs from her parents in the same house where she grew up.
Where I live in St. Bernard, it's a very small little neighborhood, but it's mostly very conservative and, you know, now Trump supporting. So I just think, you know, you have to think bigger than just like, well, you know, how am I going to do this? Or how is this regular person going to really, you know, make some kind of difference? But to me, if not us, then who? If we are not going to do this, maybe nobody's going to do it. And that's why we are in the situation that we are in. What I know now, like I said, that I did not know prior to 2017 in that Women's March, is there is at least thousands of us, you know, that are like me and that care a whole lot, that do not have the experience, but we have the heart, you know, and we have the passion to go out and make a difference.
After the overwhelming success of the first march, Billy became an even more vocal progressive activist.
My family knew that I was getting very vocal about it when the election happened in 2016. They called me a terrorist. They've told me, like, I, you know, hate my own race. I hate my own people because I do stand up for people that need it. It doesn't bother me really now. 3 years into it, I wouldn't change a thing. I wouldn't back down. I wouldn't change my views. I wouldn't be silent about it. Me and my parents are closer, and they're also lifelong Republicans. But they are super proud of what I'm doing. They don't understand it fully, but they're super proud of it. This last election, November 5th, we just voted for the first candidate ever, all the same, that we all loved and agreed. She's progressive, and I thought, okay, maybe we're getting somewhere. We're regular people. We all work full time. We have families. We have aging parents that we're all trying to take care of. Yet we find the time to put in effort to make some kind of difference. And I mean, I think that's all of it. So if we could just get, you know, a couple more million people to pay attention and care, I think it'd just be world changing.
This is Susan Burns reporting from Cincinnati, Ohio.
That's our show for this week. Thanks to Tina Rennick for production assistance. Our executive producer is Dr. Alan Shartok. Our theme music is Glow in the Dark by Kevin Bartlett. This show is a national production of Northeast Public Radio. If you'd like to hear this show again, sign up for our podcast or visit the 51% archives on our website at wamc.org. This week's show is number 1598.